Our history of ancient Rome begins in the middle of the 1st century BCE, more than 600 years after the city was founded. It begins with the promise of revolution, with a terrorist conspiracy to destroy the city, with undercover operations and public harangues, with a battle fight fought between Romans and Romans, and with citizens, innocent or not, rounded up and summarily executed in the interests of homeland security. The year is 63 BCE. On the one side is Lucius Sergius Catilina, Catiline in English, a disgruntled, bankrupt aristocrat, and the architect of a plot, so it was believed, to assassinate Rome's elected officials and burn the place down, writing off all debts of rich and poor alike in the process. On the other side is Marcus Tullius Cicero, just Cicero from now on, the famous orator, philosopher, priest, poet, politician, wit, and raconteur, one of those marked out for assassination, and a man who never ceased to use his rhetorical talents to boast how he had uncovered Catiline's terrible plot and saved the state. This was his finest hour. In 63 BCE, the city of Rome was a vast metropolis of more than 1 million inhabitants, larger than any other in Europe before the 19th century. And although as yet it had no emperors, it ruled over an empire stretching from Spain to Syria, from the south of France to the Sahara. It was a sprawling mixture of luxury and filth, liberty and exploitation, civic pride and murderous civil war. In the chapters that follow, we shall look much further back to the very start of Roman time and to the early exploits, belligerent and otherwise, of the Rome people. We shall think about what lies behind some of those stories of early Rome that still strike a chord today, from Romulus and Remus to the rape of Lucretia. And we shall be asking questions that historians have asked since antiquity itself. How and why did an ordinary little town in central Italy grow so much bigger than any other city in the ancient Mediterranean and come to control such a huge empire? What, if anything, was special about the Romans? But with the history of Rome, it makes little sense to begin the story at the very beginning. It is only in the 1st century BCE that we can start to explore Rome close up and in vivid detail through contemporary eyes. An extraordinary wealth of words survives from this period, from private letters to public speeches, from philosophy to poetry, epic and erotic, scholarly and straight from the street. Thanks to all this, we can still follow the day-to-day wheeling and dealing of Rome's political grandees. We can eavesdrop on their bargaining and their trade-offs and glimpse their backstabbing and metaphorical and literal. We could even get a taste of their private lives, their marital tariffs, their cash flow problems, their grief at the death of beloved children, or occasionally of their beloved slaves. There is no earlier period in the history of the West that it is possible to get to know quite so well or so intimately. We have nothing like such rich and varied evidence from classical Athens. It is not for more than a millennium in the world of Renaissance Florence that we find any other place that we can know in such detail again. What is more, it was during the 1st century BCE that Roman writers themselves began systematically to study the earlier centuries of their city and their empire. Curiosity about Rome's past certainly goes back further than that. We can still read, for example, an analysis of the city's rise to power written by a Greek resident in the mid-2nd century BCE. But it is only from the first century BCE that Roman scholars and critics began to pose many of the historical questions that we still pose even now. By a process that combined learned research with a good deal of constructive invention, they pieced together a version of early Rome that we still rely on today. We still see Roman history, at least in part, through 1st century BCE eyes. Or, to put it another way, Roman history, as we know it, started here. 63 BCE is a significant year in that crucial century. It was a time of near disaster for the city. Over the 1,000 years that we will be exploring in this book, Rome faced danger and defeat many times. Around 390 BCE, for example, a posse of marauding Gauls occupied the city. In 218 BCE, the Carthaginian warlord, Hannibal, famously crossed the Alps with his 37 elephants and inflicted terrible losses on the Romans before they eventually managed to fight him off. Roman estimates of casualties at the Battle of Cannae in 216 BCE, up to 70,000 deaths in a single afternoon, make it as great as a bloodbath as Gettysburg or the first day of the Somme, maybe even greater. And almost equally fearsome in the Roman imagination, in the 70s BC, a scratch force of ex-gladiators and runways under the command of Spartacus proved more than a match for some ill-trained legions. The Romans were never as invincible in battle as we tend to assume, or as they like to make it out. In 63 BC, however, they faced the enemy within, a terrorist plot at the heart of the Roman establishment. The story of this crisis can still be traced in intimate detail, day by day, occasionally hour by hour. We know precisely where much of it happened, and in a few places we can still look up to some of the same monuments as dominated the scene in 63 BC. We can follow the sting operations that give Cicero his information on the plot and see how Catiline was forced out of the city to his makeshift army north of Rome and into a battle with the official Roman legions that cost him his life. We can also glimpse some of the arguments, controversies, and wider questions that crisis raised and still does. The tough responses by Cicero, including those summary executions presented in stark form, issues that trouble us even today. Is it legitimate to eliminate terrorists outside the due processes of law? How far should civil rights be sacrificed in the interests of homeland security? The Romans never ceased to debate the conspiracy of Catiline as it came to be known. Was Catiline wholly evil, or was there something to be said in mitigation of what he did? At what price was revolution averted? The events of 63 BC and the catchphrases created then have continued to resonate throughout Western history. Some of the exact words spoken in the tense debates that followed the discovery of the plot still find their places in our own political rhetoric and are still, as we shall see, paraded on the placards and banners and even in the tweets of modern political protest. Whatever its rights and wrongs, the conspiracy takes us to the center of Roman political life in the first century BC, to its conventions, controversies, and conflicts. In doing so, it allows us to glimpse in action the Senate and the Roman people, the two institutions whose names are embedded in my title, SPQR, Senatus Populus Q Romanus. Individually, and sometimes in bitter opposition, these were the main sources of political authority in the first century BC Rome. Together, they formed a shorthand slogan for the legitimate power of the Roman state, a slogan that lasted throughout Roman history and continues to be used in Italy in the 21st century CE. More widely still, the Senate, minus the populus Q Romanus, has lent its name to modern legislative assemblies in the world over, from the USA to Rwanda. The cast of characters in the crisis includes some of the most famous figures in Roman history. Gaius Julius Caesar, then in his 30s, made a radical contribution to the debate on how to punish the conspirators. Marcus Lucianus Crassus, and the Roman plutocrat, who notoriously remarked that you could count no one rich if he did not have the cash to raise his own private army, played some mysterious part behind the scenes. But center stage, as Catiline's main adversary, we find the one person whom it is possible to get to know better than anyone else in the whole of the ancient world. Cicero's speeches, essays, letters, jokes, and poetry still fill dozens of volumes of modern printed text. There is no one else in antiquity until Augustine, Christian saint, prolific theologian, and avid self-scrutinizer, 450 years later, whose life is documented in public and private fully enough to be able to reconstruct a plausible biography in modern times. And it is largely through Cicero's writing, his eyes, and his prejudices that we see the Roman world of the first century BC and much of the city's history up to this day. The year 63 BC was the turning point of his career, for things were never quite so good for Cicero again. His career ended 20 years later in failure. Still confident of his own importance, occasionally named to conjure with no longer in the front rank, he was murdered in the civil wars that followed the assassination of Julius Caesar in 44 BC, his head and right hand pinned up on the center of Rome for all to see, and to mangle and maim. Cicero's grisly death predated a yet bigger revolution in the first century BC, which began with a form of popular political power, even if not a democracy exactly, and ended with an autocrat established on the throne in the Roman Empire under one-man rule. Though Cicero may have saved the state in 63 BC, the truth is that the state in form, the form he knew, was not to last much longer. There was another revolution on the horizon, which would be more successful than Catiline's. To the Senate and Roman people was soon added the overweening figure of the emperor, embodied in a series of autocrats who were part of the Western history, flattered and abused, obeyed and ignored for centuries. But that is a story for later in SPQR. For now, we shall put down our feet in one of the most memorable, meatiest, and most revealing moments in the whole of Roman history. Cicero versus Catiline. The conflict between Cicero and Catiline was partly a clash of political ideology and ambition, but it was also a clash between men of very different backgrounds. Both of them stood at, or very near, the top of Roman politics. But that is where the similarity ends. In fact, their contrasting careers offer a vivid illustration of just how varied political life in Rome of the first century BC can be. Catiline, the would-be revolutionary, had the more conventional, more privileged, and apparently safer start in life, as in politics. He came from a distinguished old family that traced its lineage back centuries to the mythical founding fathers of Rome. His ancestor, Sergestus, was said to have fled from the east to Italy with Aeneas over the Trojan War, before the city of Rome had even existed. Among his blue-blooded forebears, his great-grandfather was a hero of the war against Hannibal, with the extra claim to fame of being the first man to have entered combat with a prosthetic hand, probably just a metal hook that replaced his right hand, lost in an earlier battle. Catiline himself had a successful early career that was elected to a series of junior political offices, but in 63 BC, he was close to bankruptcy. A string of crimes was attached to his name, from the murder of his wife and his own son to sex with a virgin priestess. Sorry, my washing machine is making lots of noises in the background. Also, I don't know if I'm pronouncing some of these names correctly, so, this is just, it is what it is. But whatever his expensive vices, his financial problems came partly from its repeated attempts to secure election as one of the two consuls, the most powerful political posts in the city. Electioneering at Rome could be a costly business. By the first century BC, it required the kind of lavish generosity that is not always easy to distinguish from bribery. The stakes were high. The men who were successful in the elections had the chance to recoup their outlay, legally or illegally, with some of the perks of office. The failures and the like, military defeats, there were many more of those in Rome than is usually acknowledged, fell even more deeply into debt. This was Catiline's position after he had been beaten in the annual elections for the consulship in both 64 BC and 63 BC. Although the usual story is that he had been leaning in that direction before, he now had little option but to resort to revolution or direct action or terrorism, whichever you choose to call it. Joining forces with the upper-class desperados in similar straits, he appealed to the support of the discounted poor within the city while mustering his makeshift army outside of it. And there was no end to his rash promises of debt relief, one of the most despicable forms of radicalism in the eyes of the Roman landed classes, or to his bold threats to take the leading politicians and to put the whole city into flames. Or so Cicero, who was the one of those who believed he had been earmarked for destruction, summed up his adversary's motives and aims. He was of a very different stock from Catiline. He came from a wealthy, landed background, and as all level Roman politicians did, but his origins lay outside the capital in the small town of Arpinum, about 70 miles from Rome, or at least a day's journey on the ancient speed of travel. Though they must have been major players locally, no one in his family before him had ever been prominent on the Roman political scene. With none of Catiline's advantages, Cicero relied on his native talents and the high-level connections he assiduously cultivated, and on speaking his way to the top. That is to say, His main claim to fame was as a star advocate in the Roman courts, and the celebrity status and prominent supporters that this gave him meant that he was easily elected to each of the required series of junior officers in turn. Just like Catiline, but in 64 BC, where Catiline failed, Cicero succeeded in winning the race for the next year's consulship. That crowning success had not been an entirely foregone conclusion. For all his celebrity, Cicero faced the disadvantages of being a new man, as the Romans called those without political ancestry. And at one stage, he even seems to have considered making an electoral pact with Catiline, seedy reputation or not. But in the end, the influential voters swayed it. The Roman electoral system openly and unashamedly gave extra weight to the votes of the rich, and many of them must have concluded that Cicero was a better option than Catiline, whatever their snobbish disdain for his newness. Some of his rivals called him a lodger at Rome, a part-time citizen, but he topped the poll. Catiline ended up in the unsuccessful third place. In second place, elected as the other consul, Gaius Antonius Hybrida, uncle of a more famous Antonius Mark Antony, whose reputation turned out to be not much better than Catiline's. By the summer of 63 BC, Cicero appears to have not have got wind of definite danger from Catiline, who was trying his luck as a candidate again. Using his authority as consul, Cicero postponed the next round of elections, and when he finally did let them go ahead, he turned up at the poll with an armed guard and wearing a military breastplate clearly visible under his toga. It was a historic display, and the combination of civilian and military kit was alarmingly incongruous, rather, as if a modern politician were to enter the legislature in a business suit with a machine gun slung over his shoulders. But it worked. These scare tactics, combined with Catiline's vociferously populist program, made sure that he was much more defeated. Claiming that he was a down-and-out standing for other down-and-outs could hardly have endeared him to elite voters. Soon after the election, sometime in the early autumn, Cicero began to receive much clearer intelligence of a violent plot. For a long time, he had been getting trickles of information through the girlfriend of one of Catiline's accomplices, a woman named Fulvia, who had more or less turned a double agent. Now, thanks to a further piece of treachery from the other side and via the wealthy Marcus Crassus as intermediary, he had a bundle of letters in his hands that directly incriminated Catiline and referred to the terrible bloodshed that was planned. Information soon supplemented by definite reports of armed forces gathering north of the city in support of the insurrection. Finally, after he dodged an assassination attempt planned for 7 November, thanks to a tip-off from Fulvia, Cicero summoned the Senate to meet the next day so that he could formally denounce Catiline and frighten him out of Rome. The senators had already, in October, issued a decree urging or allowing Cicero as consul to make sure that the state could come to no harm, roughly the ancient equivalent of a modern emergency powers or Prevention of Terrorism Act, and no less controversial. Now, on 8 November, they listened while Cicero went through the whole case against Catiline in a blistering and well-informed attack. It was a marvelous mixture of fury, indignation, self-criticism, and apparently solid fact. One minute, he was reminding the assembled company of Catiline's notorious past. The next, he was disingenuously regretting that he himself had not reacted the danger speedily enough. The next, he was pouring out precise details of the plot, in whose house the conspirators had gathered, on what dates, who was involved, and what exactly their plans were. Catiline had turned up to face the denunciation in person. He asked the senators not to believe everything they were told and made some jibes about Cicero's modest background, compared with his own distinguished ancestors and their splendid achievements. But he must have realized that his positions were hopeless. Overnight, he left town.